Good morning and good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Higher Dimensions. I'm Phyllis Pricer, your hostess, and I have with me a wonderful guest today, and just the way he spells his name, I want to say Reels, is that correct, or is it Riles?
It's actually Riles.
Riles. Okay,
it's
I had a certain pronunciation waiting on hand, right, State Center? Anyway, welcome to the Higher Dimension, and I don't have too much about your life and how this came to be, but I'll read a little bit of what I have here, sir, if you don't mind.
Okay.
You have this marvelous, marvelous book, Drunk with Wonder, Awakening to the God Within, and I've told my audience about this for a couple of weeks now because I'm so impressed with it. And Mr. Reels lives with his wife, Joanne, in Mendocino County in Northern California, and they are going green or gone green with electricity from solar panels, so I wonder how that works in winter when it's snowing. And that it doesn't have much in there about you and the details of how you came to write this marvelous, marvelous book, but it is a wonderful book that I read and couldn't put down. But it was one of the few books, I have to be honest with you, that took me a while to read, Steve, because like with other books that make me go in within my own mind and examine my own heart and my emotions and question, I could only read a chapter at a time. Normally, I just, you know, grab a book and I just sort of slurp it down like a really good dessert. But this is one of those that has to be read, chewed thoroughly, and then digested. And
thank
I loved it.
Thank you. The goal was to provide a very full, flavored, if you will, book that had a lot to give people. That was my goal, is to be of service.
Well, you know, you've met your goal, at least as far as I'm concerned.
Thanks.
Anyway, at any rate, I wanted to know a bit more how this came back to it. I know in your introduction, you did give a little bit of how you came to do this. You suffered an injury, sporting injury almost. What it is when you were shooting. And anyway, looks like medicine. I'm sorry. I don't know. You have this information. Yes. Somebody's calling in already. Who is this?
Good afternoon. My name is Kari.
I'm sorry?
Kari,
yes. How may I help you, ma'am?
Just kind of calling in for a general reading. I haven't heard your show before.
Oh, okay. I'm afraid you'd have to wait a little bit because we're talking to the wonderful author who wrote Drunk with Wonder.
Okay.
So we're not doing readings right at this moment.
That's fine.
But you know, would you listen for a while and then feel free to call back in?
Yes, that'd be great. Thank you.
Thank you so very much. Thank you.
Afternoon. Thanks.
Right. I'm sorry, Steve.
No problem.
Anyway, I'm reading the introduction, and what it is, it seems to be as though you have done something. You said your shooting buddy speared your flesh.
Yes, and that's a reference to actually a heavy drug use.
Oh, okay.
I was actually shooting drugs, shooting methadrine.
Well, that's not a sport, is it?
Well, most people don't think so, that's for sure.
Doesn't work through for me, no.
Competitive drug use.
Competitive drug use. Now, that's an interesting sport.
Don't think I'll go there.
I think there are a few people who would like to try it.
I suspect there are people who do it all the time, actually.
However, this one time seems to have completed something different. Why don't you tell us, as this appears to be the way you started off, as a wake-up call, was it not?
Well, it was a profound wake-up call. I was I had really slipped into a very extensive drug use as a teenager, and this you know, and that came about from growing up in the 50s and 60s in a family that, well, my parents loved us all. I'm the oldest of five boys. There was also a lot of what we now call and understand as physical and emotional abuse.
Right.
You know, it seemed normal at the time.
Yeah.
That's how you raise kids. You scared the heck out of them and,
terrified
them and, you know, and kept them in line kind of thing.
Yeah, and it worked.
And, well, to a certain extent, I
never went off the short deep end. I'm raised, I guess we're about the same age. I'm in my middle 60s.
I'll be 60 this year.
You know. Ah, so I'm a little ahead of you. Gotcha. Go ahead.
But I had a lot of emotional trauma that I didn't know what to do with. And became an expert at distracting myself at an early age with reading primarily and in my imagination. But then as a teenager, I discovered drugs and how for a long time I misunderstood or, misapprehended the numbness that drugs would give me for actual feeling good, because feeling numb seemed like a step up from feeling horrible.
I see.
So I got lost, and I really got lost in the world of drugs. And by the time that this episode happened that I write about in my introduction to Drunk with Wonder, I was in basically what's called a crash pad in Southern California, out in Riverside, and was shooting a lot of methamphetamines, which is speed, crystal meth, and doing other drugs. And a friend of mine, who I had I've been very close with, going to the high school I had gone to, I had become a dropout at that point, came out to visit me and was shocked and horrified by what he found. And he occasioned me to take and I have to repeat this, don't try this at home, kids, but he gave me a large dose, what they call the shaman's dose of a psychedelic, to try to get me to see, to really deeply understand what I was doing to myself. He didn't want me to kill myself, and he saw me dying.
Mm-hmm.
And so I, and then he was kind of like an intervention, and then he stormed out. He was extremely angry with me, and quite understandably. And so I
stormed out, leaving you there with.
Yeah, he left me there, and just I was lying on my bed, and
my God,
couldn't move, and and so the next thing I remember really getting was that I had was feeling as though I had gotten out of my body.
Okay.
And I was I felt as though I was kind of like a balloon bumping along the ceiling.
Right, okay.
And it occurred to me to go, wow, I could look down on myself, huh? So I kind of arranged to turn myself, I felt like I was turning myself over, and I looked down at my body, very, very clear. And yes, my friend was correct. I was dying. I was literally dying. I was down to 135 pounds and very emaciated. My teeth were rotting, and my, just to be really blunt, I stank. And I couldn't even move. And I realized that if I wanted to just actually die, that I could just shoot a bunch more speed and I'd be gone. And so I was faced with that very profound question, do I live or do I die? Yeah, obviously, I chose to live, and I came down from that experience and called my parents the next day, and they came and picked me up, and I moved home, and within 3 weeks or so, I had started seeing a therapist and was, adding weight and had gone to the dentist, just really cleaning up my act,
right.
And went to celebrate on May Day, returning home, and I went up to my friend's house, and just as I walked through the door, his family discovered that he had been killed in a motorcycle accident by a drunk driver.
Oh, no.
So that sent me off into this whole other place of profound grief and no modeling, no teaching of any kind of how to deal with these profound emotional issues, which is what had got me into the drugs in the first place, was having no idea how to deal with great emotional pain. And
right.
So within a couple of months, I had discovered alcohol, and so I went off into alcohol for many years. I actually drank on and off for 33 years and quit about a little over 8 years ago now. So I've, cleared that one up. But one of the things that came out of this, one of the gifts, was that summer after my friend passed away, I started having these very vivid dreams where he would come and visit me.
Okay.
And he was clearly going on about his business, as it were. We talked about his passing away. We talked about how he was in great shape. He was, you know, doing what he wanted to do. He was in the, or like the spirit world, and
right.
And you know, to not grieve and to not think that there was anything wrong with him, or
mm-hmm.
you know, that we couldn't be together physically, but we'd always be connected
right.
with our hearts, and
right.
that was enormously comforting. And it kind of got me started down the road of some kind of spirituality. I had been an active atheist up until that point.
Really?
Then I started getting interested in tarot cards and just
right.
kind of in this whole... Then I got interested in yoga, and I got
okay.
very interested in what Ram Dass had to say
okay.
when he came
yep.
back from India, and away I went, you know.
Yeah.
So I was kind of like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, Phyllis. I was,
yeah.
I was, you know, on the one hand, I was really interested in mysticism and metaphysics and
mm-hmm.
spirituality. And on the other hand, I was still consuming large quantities of alcohol and recreational drugs of various kinds. And I just kind of wandered through a lot of my life. I helped raise stepkids and had a job and then started a business and was very successful financially, and, you know, went through this, you've probably heard this story 1,000 times, where, you know, no matter how much you make, there's still this emptiness inside, and you,
mm-hmm.
hopefully people eventually realize that, oh, it, you know, it, I'm never going to get enough as long as I'm looking outside of myself to
right.
get enough,
right.
you know, and anyhow, I went through so many of those kinds of experiences, and then when I was able to let go of drinking in early 2001, I started journaling and doing a lot of healing and awakening,
uh-huh.
and eventually came to the realization that this book really wanted to come out, and I wanted it specifically in the format of a dialogue.
Because I
thought it might be helpful to some people to get a sense of
powerful
that young kind of
yes.
kind of arrogant kind of. You know, certain that he knew all the answers, talking with an older partner, an older self, in a way.
Right.
And it sounds like you thought that was useful.
Extremely useful. Okay. I and it's funny the way you're speaking. Are you familiar with a person called Jose Arguelles?
Oh, sure.
Okay. He has. I'm reading an autobiography of him right now, and a biography, not an autobiography, a biography. And the authoress will probably be on my show. You will note that I use quaint terms like author and authoress. You know, I really hate the word you guys when people talk to me, and I look down and check to make sure I'm still a girl. But at any rate, it sounds like you had very similar paths. His was more with the art world. But what you're talking about is a very, very similar journey.
Yeah, I think...
which I find absolutely fascinating.
I think that there is, it is kind of an archetypal journey. I've heard it called the shaman's journey, healing journey.
Yes, I've heard that also, which is interesting because I'm of that same period. But you know what? I never had any desire to do drugs, ever. I was about the straight-laced Catholic girl as you could get. brought up in a convent school,
wow.
and I didn't go wild when I got out, so... That surprised a whole bunch of young men who thought that young ladies who were brought up would go absolutely wild sexually once they got out. Surprise,
uh-huh.
surprise. And I missed the whole drug scene, but I went on a similar journey, but without the use of alcohol and drugs. And it's very interesting because it never occurred to me that you couldn't, I guess I always felt that if you could achieve this with drugs, why couldn't you just achieve it? I guess I already knew you could achieve it, being stone cold sober. And since I have had a couple of times when I've drunk a little too much, hangovers not being my favorite form of therapy,
mm-hmm.
I never really got into that scene, and also have control issues. I like to know what I'm doing at all times.
Yeah, it's amazing to be able to have a nice evening and then remember it the next morning.
It is. And my girlfriends and I used to call ourselves Pepsi-holics. We used to get such a rousing good time just laughing hysterically and with hijinks that, and all we did was drink Pepsi, you know, and I'm sure they weren't sneaking anything in at that point in time.
Right.
Maybe earlier in the century, but not then. And I just didn't understand how you could have any greater time than just to be with friends and just roll around laughing and howling, leaving you gasping for breath. But it's funny, but, you know, I'm seeing now that there are many people who've gone through this particular phase, and yet I've been told that I've been doing the same thing, a shamanic journey, I just find it interesting that we, through our separate pathways, are still trotting the same path to, or having the same destination, even though the way of arriving at it seems to be somewhat different.
Yeah, there seem to be as many paths as there are people to trod them.
And yet
we're all going home, you know.
Yes,
we're all heading home.
You're down mm-hmm. that road. Yes, we are. The other thing I notice is that while you deadened your pain with alcohol, and I had a great deal of pain too, it didn't occur to me to deaden it. I just toughed it through, which is interesting because there were a number of very traumatic instances from early childhood on. But, you know, using or copping out or, I guess, just at least that's the way you see the word I'm using,
mm-hmm.
is it, and it may not be the proper word to use, but to cover it over didn't seem to me to be the wisest course of action, because I guess I equated it with health. If you have a cut, if you have an injury, and you simply cover it up and don't address it, it simply goes down and infection ensues. And I guess using it in medical terms, that's what it would be considered as, until you finally recognize there's something really wrong, or as you called, no feeling.
Yeah, I think, I mean, I think you had a much clearer, you were much more clear-headed about it than I ever was. It wasn't as though I had the consciousness to say, wow, I'm in a lot of emotional pain. I wonder what I could do to numb it out. You know, I wasn't that conscious. It wasn't that clear.
Well, guys don't, you know. You've got to realize that. Guys, for the most part, you just tough it out because you're a guy.
Yeah, well, that's the story that,
yes.
You know, as I've taken on clients and so on as a feelings coach, and work particularly with men, I think it's one of the great, for me, one of the great sadnesses in our culture.
Yes.
We all of us have such a rich heritage of wonderful emotions, powerful emotions, some of which have been labeled negative, and many of which have been labeled as undesirable to feel, or certainly to experience, because in our culture, anyone who is expressing emotion is labeled as weak, and to be harassed or bullied or teased or taken advantage
mocked or taken advantage of is a good one. They do that with women, by the way.
Yes.
You're perceived as vulnerable in the business world. You know, you face, and I'm a veteran of that, you face people who really try to go after you and sabotage you.
Yes, so this whole idea of, for me, I grew up in the culture and the world. It's like I grew up where, and I think it's only accelerated greatly in the last 30 or 40 years, where we look outside ourselves to get fixed. Many of us do. There's a pill for everything. There's a drug or a pill and I mean legally in our culture. There's never this sense of if you're feeling down, you know, take some, what is that, Zoloft or whatever those, you know.
Xanax.
That there's Xanax, you know, that
whatever.
there's never any sense, never any teaching, it seems, to work through emotions from a spiritual perspective, from a more conscious perspective, and look at the cause. You know, I was at a all-day youth conference yesterday. I work a lot with teens, and we had a breakout session on drugs and alcohol, and, you know, people were talking for a while about strategies to essentially keep kids busy so that they wouldn't, you know, it's like the idle hands or the devil's workshop kind of thing. And I came along and says, well, what if, what if we could address the core issues? What if alcohol and drug abuse were symptoms rather than cause? And if we could work on the cause, then this itch to do something something to alter our consciousness so we wouldn't feel all this turmoil and all this pain and fear, would not be there. And so we spent the rest of the time, you know, talking about it from that perspective.
Well, I think you're absolutely 100% correct on that. Absolutely. You know, this is a culture that seems to deify medication. The problem is almost every medication now comes with caveat of how much more can go wrong with you if you take it. And I'm thinking, and this is an improvement.
Exactly.
You could die from it. You know, you get cured of this, but you could die from it, you know?
Exactly.
And I'm thinking, how much better off are we on this planet from that? It's absolutely marvelous what you're talking about. I could cite another example, but this show is about you, so I'm not going to go into it. We're going to talk more about you and your discovery and your journey down the road, which I just love. You have written a marvelous book, I have to tell you that, and I would encourage my readers, listeners rather, to go and read his book because it is a phenomenal book. It takes you on this absolutely terrific journey of the individual mind, of your very essence of being, and you meet yourself within, which is what you're supposed to do. That's what I perceive it as. If this is incorrect, please let me know.
Oh no, I think like many people who've had some awakening in their lives, the story seems to be very similar, which is that, or the message is very similar, in that there is a divinity within us, that our very birthright is divinity itself. And so when we, in this culture, we're taught that we have little or no worth intrinsically, that the only worth we can have is how we show up in the world, is what we do, how much money we make, what kind of car we drive, how expensive our perfume is, you know, what neighborhood we live in, you know, yada, yada, what kind of clothes, what kind of product purses we wear. It's stuff-based, and it's also fear-based in the sense that if you don't have this, you will not be seen as a desirable mate, for example.
Right.
And you'll be lonely and ostracized, and you won't be cool. And, you know, I mean, you know, death is much to be preferred to not being cool, you know, for heaven's sake. I think this is an eternal message. Certainly we can trace it back for thousands of years that it's an inside job, that it's our very birthright. We get all of the self-worth, if you will, that we could ever imagine just from being children of God, Goddess. And that when we start to realize that and start to understand that our emotions are a way that our spirit talks with us.
Right.
And that we, each of us, have within us, as part of our divine birthright, a higher self, a higher intelligence, a soul who is stands ever ready to love us unconditionally and to support us in making healthy choices, whether they're emotional or physical or spiritual choices, is ever ready and not in a negative or condemning or harshly authoritarian way.
It's
only love. You know, Phyllis, I love thinking of Lady Kuan Yin. Who's the goddess of mercy and compassion and forgiveness.
She's a statue I have standing in my yard.
As do we.
See, great minds do run in the same channel.
Exactly. I really feel that is when so many of the interviews I've done and wonderful interviewers and hosts I've spoken with, we just really seem to share this basic idea that we can have it all in the sense that we are it all. That as Marianne Williamson wrote and Nelson Mandela spoke in his inaugural address, it is not our darkness, it is our light that we most fear.
That
it is our magnificence, you know, not our shadow. And as long as we stay stuck in victim consciousness, it's your fault that I'm not doing okay. You know,
who
and you can fill in the blank with whoever you are.
Whatever,
is.
Yes, exactly.
then we get to stay in our little comfort zone of the world and my life is somebody else's fault.
Exactly.
So I'm helpless and there's nothing I can do about it, so I might as well open another beer and turn on the tube, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas when we begin to take responsibility and take ownership, not in a pejorative way, not
right.
in a negative way, just simply, okay, I'm in charge of my life.
Exactly.
Then we can begin to make the choices that turn our life into a joy-based adventure.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I agree 100%. And this is why I found your book so compelling, because I think you've written it in a way that is far superior to ones that I have read. I am reading a lot of books that are saying somewhat similar things, but I think the way, for some reason, the way you've written your book, it resonates even more with me, and I'm not sure why that is. I can only tell you that it is so.
Well, I appreciate your kind words so much. I really tried to be, pretty contemporary with it. In Drunk with Wonder, I talk about imagining our world, our reality,
yeah.
our universe as a coin, and
mm-hmm.
and to be able to pick that coin up. And one side of the coin says spirituality or religion, and the other
right.
side reads science.
Right.
And so I'm fascinated by science.
Absolutely.
I am fascinated by how what we're learning, I mean, right
yes.
at the cutting edge of what we're
yes.
learning about physics, is so in
yes.
line with what metaphysicians have been teaching for thousands of years.
Absolutely.
That, you know, it's not just a story that we're all interconnected.
No.
We really are, at a quantum
really
level,
are.
All interconnected.
and
that
yes.
kind of thing.
Literally, and which is why we can feel sympathy and empathy for others, and why there's so much. Now, you do coaching and you do counseling. I'm a hypnotherapist.
Uh-huh.
And so I find that what I have found with hypnosis is that most of the people who have undergone a long bit of therapy, it doesn't help them because they intellectualize what they're doing. They explore it intellectually. My own opinion, after being not only hypnotized but working hypnosis, is that part of the issue that of the failure to heal a lot of times is that the emotional portion of experiences is not released.
That's right.
It's not addressed. It's used as an intellectual exercise, but it's not released. Where I think, and it's been my experience, that the emotional portion of all experiences is the glue that holds everything together. And if you do not bring out the emotional healing, you're not going to have permanent healing.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. My wife is a spiritual coach, and she works with EFT, emotional freedom technique.
Yes, I've worked with that too. Yes,
she's had she has tremendous success with that.
Yeah.
And yes, hypnotherapy is powerful. When I started, use the word loosely, but it's in essence channeling my higher self.
Yes.
Way back in 91. It was with a friend who had become a hypnotherapist.
Huh.
I had no idea that any of, you know, this kind of a direct connection could be made until it was almost, 18 years ago.
Huh.
And so that, I really identify strongly with what you're saying. In fact, as I write about in Drunk with Wonder, what I've come to realize is that emotional trauma specifically,
right.
painful emotional experiences,
yes.
wind up getting locked into cellular memory
yes,
with
exactly.
adrenaline. You
yes,
know, it's a, it's
it
this big adrenaline punch.
Yes.
And there's and I go into some detail about the the hereditary or biological reasons why we would evolve this way. And they're very straightforward, actually.
Yes.
It makes perfect sense when you think about it.
Yes.
But I couldn't agree more that cognitive therapy, intellectual talk therapy, is relatively useless for many people, and it's why they can go for years and not really feel any different. I think the best thing a lot of that therapy can really offer is to help people cope with the trauma.
Right.
But
yes.
the good news that obviously you're sharing as well, Phyllis, is that we can heal out of this. We can
yes.
put it in our past
Absolutely.
So that it's like a movie or like a story that we read,
right,
rather than
exactly.
anything that's continuing to affect the clarity and
yes.
wisdom and full heart of our decision-making about our lives.
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. And I feel this is true with the veterans coming back with PTSD or anyone who has suffered an emotional trauma, whether it's rape or incest or abuses of various sorts. These things can be healed.
That's, I think that's the great news, is that
but there's still those out there that say you can't really be healed. And the thing is, why would you want to tell somebody that and let them go through life unhealed? There's one thing in here that I really like the way you also develop it in the chapters. The dance of duality. Now, that's a brief chapter. Do you recall that, right?
Of course.
Let's go into that, because the god of duality, people are stuck today with all of the issues that we have right now with Wall Street and everything else, the wars. Not only Afghanistan, but the violence that's going over around the world, about the duality, and they seem to want to place it squarely on the shoulders of this being called God, and not understanding how it can be. And they don't understand the duality. Does God really care about our experiences? And so forth. I'd like you to go into that a little bit, because it brings it home. Okay, that we, each of us, are God.
Yeah, well, you know, the way I hold it, the way it really resonates for me, Phyllis, is that God is all there is.
Yes.
And so we are one with God. And mm-hmm. what I believe is that God's one gift of utterly unconditional love is the gift of life itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so the universe, as we understand it, is singularly constructed in a way that makes life not only possible, but inevitable. All, the laws of physics, the way that the stars create all of the elements that are in our bodies and on the Earth, and that we are literally starseed, it's amazing to me. And to understand that the gift of love, the ultimate gift of love, is life, and then what life does with that gift is mm-hmm. up to life.
Yep.
Not up to God.
That's right.
And so there's a way in which when we make it God's fault, we are continuing to be victims. And what we are being offered is the opportunity to choose to step into our divinity.
Right.
And to encourage other people to step into their divinity and see themselves mm-hmm. as holy and sacred, and to see all of life mm-hmm. as holy and sacred. I mean, you know, wars come about because people are terrified.
Well, yeah, and they think there's not enough to go around.
Which is another, to me, a complete fabrication. I believe in an
Certainly.
Unlimited universe,
exactly.
in a super abundant universe, where there is more than enough to go around.
Absolutely.
But we've been taught in our culture a scarcity-based, fear-based consciousness, and that makes it a lot easier to sell people things they don't really need for way too much money.
Well, yeah, true. And for other people to try and take it from someone else, because, golly, there's not enough to go around. And you're right. There isn't. And accepting personal responsibility for one's own thoughts and one's own actions are very, very important.
Yeah.
And we struggle against that.
The key I like to emphasize in Drunk with Wonder is that what I've come to understand is that what we really, really precisely have control over, ultimately, is not necessarily always what goes on in the world.
Right.
But how we are with what goes on in the world.
Mm-hmm.
We have control over how we show up in the world and what we make
mm-hmm.
what I call the isness mean.
Yes.
And so there is great power in that. I mean, we have great empathy for and compassion for people who've lost jobs and who've lost their homes
mm-hmm.
and are struggling through this crazy time. And my prayer is that we we will, as a culture, as a society, as a planetary community, begin to wake up and insist that things be done differently. That and that only comes from our willingness to take responsibility, not just for ourselves and our families, but our communities.
Uh-huh.
And I keep seeing things going on that I find so incredibly helpful. You know, I live with my beloved on 40 acres that she's had up in the mountains for 34 years. We do live off the grid, and when it's snowing and raining and our pond is full, we get our power from a hydro system.
Wow.
That's been built in, and when all else fails, we have a propane backup generator.
But,
you know, we have big battery bank, and we probably don't run the generator for the equivalent of maybe 1 week a year.
Right.
You know, just a few hours at a time when we need to, but we don't. We were able to invest in a solar power upgrade last fall, so we're just really doing well. And our home is modest, but it's paid for.
Mm-hmm.
Our car is modest, but it's paid for. And so we
right.
have deliberately chosen a lifestyle where we have more freedom.
Uh-huh.
Then if you had to, and we're semi-retired, you know, my wife taught for many years and has a pension and so on. And, we've just really made deliberate choices not to be so engaged in the world. And I have to say that there were years where I was. My a former wife, who is still a close friend and a sister, we started a business 27 years ago, and you know, we were millionaires for a while, and we traveled all over and had nice cars and two homes and stuff. And one of my lessons was that I went from a time when I was homeless to a time when I had just graduated from Berkeley, and $1,000 a month was big money.
Yes, it was.
And then we got to a place where for a couple of years we were pulling in the better part of $20,000 a month, and all of it seemed to disappear, and I finally got the lesson of, it's you can never have enough if
yeah.
you are looking outside of yourself to have enough. You'll never fill that hole. And then
right.
I began to understand multimillionaires and billionaires and people ripping other people off like Bernie Madoff and so on.
Oh, yes.
As they haven't addressed any of these deep personal issues. So when they keep looking for approval or acceptance, or that they've won the game,
yes.
right, by keeping outer score.
Yes.
And, of course, it's ultimately always hollow. I'm sure you've spoken to many clients who have lots of money and are miserable.
Yes. Yes.
So that's, some of
yes.
what I work on with Drunk with Wonder is help people realize some of these things so that. And I'm not in any way saying that money's wrong or bad
it
intrinsically.
Isn't.
It's just fuel.
It's it's just a tool that you can use along with other tools in an arsenal or a quiver full of bows, arrows that you can use. And the point of fact is that if there was no duality, you would have difficulty understanding.
If there was no duality, there would not be. I mean, if you think about subject and object, that God is all there is, and there
right.
is no subject, there's just God,
mm-hmm.
how could we have a story? If there was no up or down,
yes.
this or that,
yes.
now
yes.
or then, boy yes. and girl, different
it
people
would
who
very
have...
boring.
It would, well, there wouldn't even be anybody around to say, this is boring.
Yes.
There's no if all there is consciousness without a subject, without without duality. I mean, there's a lot about and in fact I'm very attracted to non-dual awareness and that whole idea of oneness. And I find that the arguments against duality, so to speak, and that it's all an illusion are somewhat specious. Perhaps that's so on some profound metaphysical level, and yet I don't find it useful when I encounter a homeless person or a young man or woman in high school who's being terribly abused and needs to go into you know, county services, and they're terrified and rageful, and you know, striking out and acting out and saying, hey, you know, by the way, you know, duality is an illusion. They're like,
this does not work real well.
So, can you feed me an illusion of dinner? You know,
yeah, would it work well? You know.
So I you know, I think that we, God as us,
yes,
doesn't make mistakes ultimately, and that,
well,
this world isn't a mistake, and that we're not mistakes, and none of us,
yes,
none of us are mistakes, and
right.
I think many of us think somehow we are, that we're somehow broken or wrong. That's the way we were raised, and I'm here to say no. Actually, it's all the way on the other side. You're nothing less than God in form.
Right. And learning and moving and experiencing, because that's what your journey is all about. It's a journey of being alive and being aware and being consciously aware. And without duality, as I said, you wouldn't know up from down, in from out, or anything else. And as far as the other issues along those lines, I happen to agree with you. Now, a lot of what I found is in your dialogue of back and forth are questions that people would normally ask themselves. Like, you throw together a gratitude and adrenaline. Isn't that interesting?
Isn't it?
So, bring those two to me.
Well, you know, adrenaline, I am convinced, is one of the original addictions. And what I mean by addiction is simply, you know, there's a substance of some kind or an activity of some kind that feels good enough for whatever reason that we want to do more of it.
Okay, and I would say those who do extreme sports.
Well, extreme sports, jumping out of planes,
yes,
race
yes,
car drivers, you
yes,
know, snowboarders, anybody who straps waxed pieces of wood on their feet and flies down a snow-covered hill at 60 miles an hour.
Down that mountaintop.
You know, and as we saw in this tragic accident the other day, it can easily be fatal. So part of, I think, the attraction in a sense of when something might be fatal, there is a more intense adrenaline rush.
Yes.
So I think to acknowledge, okay, in one way or another, we're all adrenaline junkies. I happen to get my adrenaline hits from meditation, believe it or not, and from working with young people in particular, and going really deep, asking the question, if you really knew me,
mm-hmm,
and sitting with people as they tell their stories of mm-hmm pain and abuse and
right,
sorrow,
yes,
and then help them develop tools that they can use to heal out of that and watch the light come on in their eyes.
Yes.
That is the
Isn't
coolest
that fascinating?
Thing. And I have to say, another giant source of adrenaline for me right now is my 3-year-old granddaughter. I just got to put that in.
Oh, how neat!
I am grandpa love, I got to tell you.
I bet you're in your element.
I am totally
in love,
in bliss, totally in love, totally in bliss, totally grateful. And my stepson and his wife and my stepdaughter and her sweetie have just announced their engagement, and they that they intend to have children, at least one as well. So
yes,
I think I may get to be grandpa again.
Oh, goody.
And I think that's, you know, people, what's the point of life? Well, I'm hard-pressed to imagine someone who's had a child or a grandchild asking what is the point of life. I have a really wonderful relationship with my beloved, my wife, Joanne, and I'm grateful every day of my life for so much. In Drunk with Wonder, I encourage people to develop, if they haven't already begun, to develop some kind of spiritual practice where they're doing a form of mindfulness meditation, and where we become more and more skilled at being fully present in the moment. And whenever we're willing to do that, to show up fully in the moment,
mm-hmm,
we see that we are surrounded by multitudinous gifts,
mm-hmm,
that when we're lost in some kind of a story of fear and lack and we're not present, we're just oblivious to.
Yes, I agree. And being mindful. Talk how people become mindful in the present.
Well, what I teach is, because I think it's so simple, and many people teach this. It's not original with me. I teach people to begin to set aside a few minutes a day, even to start with five,
mm-hmm.
five whole minutes. My practice is commonly 20 minutes a day. And the idea is just simply to become still in a quiet place where you're not going to be disturbed by the phone or kids or anybody for that period of time. That's a sacrosanct period of time. And and begin to just notice your breath.
Right.
It's as simple as that. Just
yes.
notice your breath and then begin to notice your thoughts and begin to notice that you're not your thoughts. That there's
right.
an awareness, an ever-present awareness, that's noticing the thoughts.
Right.
And you can kind of begin to learn how to watch the thoughts come and go like clouds passing across the sky or
yeah.
like bubbles moving across from left to right or right to left or up or down or whatever works for you. And just begin, and then just keep breathing. Just every time you notice you've got lost in the thought, you go, okay, thanks, and release that thought and come back to your breath. And just do that for a few minutes every day or every day that you possibly can. And over time, and you've got to give new habits, new ideas, time to generate neuronal pathways.
Yeah.
What I find inevitably is that people begin to get a little bit of a detachment from being so locked into their thoughts. They realize, oh, this is not a healthy thought. I'm really going to let that one go, and that choosing to be in a quietly meditative, blissful state is in itself joy based.
Uh-huh.
Because the gift of love from God, the gift of life, is a joy based gift,
uh-huh.
and we are taught that joy is something that's elusive. And hard to come by, and it often requires a lot of money or an expensive vacation or, certain special times.
Uh-huh.
And my teaching, and many teachers teach the same thing, is that joy is actually only available right here and right now.
Right.
It's never going to be in the future sometime.
Well,
it's
you know,
only
say,
here.
If only this happens, then I'll be joyous.
Right.
Joyous is it's in the moment that you are taking that breath. That you have that awareness of perfection.
Exactly. It's only now. I mean, only the present moment. Eckhart Tolle, bless his heart, has
yes.
done a great deal to publicize this understanding in the Western mind that the now moment is really all we have. The rest
right.
is a complete illusion.
Right.
And
I quite agree with that.
And so mindfulness meditation is simply a really simple way. You don't need any props. You don't need any, you don't need anything but your own willingness
mm-hmm.
and maybe a timer to give yourself the opportunity to begin to become acquainted with your own higher self. And why it can be challenging for people to get acquainted with their higher selves is because our higher selves are closer than our own shadows.
Well, yes, it's the other side of the coin. That's what
right.
it's about. This.
Right.
It's the unseen part of our own being. And do you know that I'm just throwing it out for some reason that the word squirrel is Greek for shadow.
Really?
Yeah. It's that's what it means in Greek, which is the shadow self.
Hmm.
That I don't know why it just stuck into my mind is something I found absolutely fascinating to learn. But what I was going to say also is, you also mentioned that one has to consider the ego, and it doesn't mean getting rid of the ego, because again we've been told that the ego itself is something we need to get rid of. How many lives of the saints where they, gave up everything and so forth and so on. Because everything is, if you don't kill the ego, then, everything else is, what shall I say, you don't get anywhere unless you kill the ego. I disagree with that. because that's part of who you are. It's part of who you have built. But there's a difference between the ego and egotism.
There certainly is. I quite agree with you that a healthy, what I call a healthy ego, is just part of what allows us to navigate in this world,
mm-hmm.
in meat space, if you will. I prefer the shamanic tradition of enlisting the ego as an ally in our spiritual adventures rather than thinking that there is something wrong with it. I hear all the time, I hear different teachings talking about the toxic ego and how it's wrong and bad and it's out to get you. And I'm fascinated by that because if the ego goes away, what's left? You know, who's speaking?
Who's running the show?
I'm fascinated by that. And of course, for me, the answer really is this ever-present awareness, this higher self, which is not particularly ego-based or what I would call identity-based. And that's why I'm fascinated with non-dual awareness, because non-dual awareness teaches us not to be attached to the ego's stories or attached to the physical world. And yet, it also teaches us to enjoy and appreciate the dance, rather than to go into some kind of austerity and blame or hold as negative. I really think this dance of getting rid of the ego is it's just like we're stuck on the hamster wheel still. And I get really tired of the hamster wheel and want to just get off and hang out in bliss and joy. And my ego's always done the best it could given the awareness it's had and the tools it's been given. And it gives me, you know, it gives me a lot of joy now to hang out with my ego, with my, you know, even with my little kid. That's what lets me get down on the floor and roll around and be crazy and play with my granddaughter at her level, with just utterly, you know, open and guileless and absolutely innocent in her play, and just hang out with her and not care what the neighbors think or, you know, other people who are sitting up on the couch speaking as adults, you know, would think. I just don't care. What I care about is that I am doing the very best I can in each moment to be the change I wish to see in the world, as Gandhi put it, to be the love I am, not talk about it, not go on and on to other people about what they should do, but just show up in my life the best I can, the most loving I can.
Well, that's what being egoless is all about, in a sense. It's being true to yourself in the purest form of meeting oneself face to face and liking who you are. One of the first examples that I did, I don't know if you're familiar with Edgar Cayce.
Oh, sure.
Okay. Well, in dealing with the beginnings, and I started reading about Edgar Cayce back in my early 20s, there are a few other books that I've read along the way, to say the least. But one of the hardest things I found to do when I first got into this was to look into a mirror at me and to say, I love you. I love who you are. I love who you are becoming. To say that to myself and mean it and not be embarrassed or uncomfortable or anything else. That is so difficult because we are taught that loving self is selfishness. Now, why we shouldn't love ourselves, I don't know, because if we can't love who we are, how could we possibly love anything or anyone?
I agree with you completely. And
that was very difficult for me, extremely difficult for me to learn.
Now, you mentioned the difference between ego and egotism.
Yes.
And, you know, having a healthy ego is just, you know, having a healthy regard and a healthy love for the God goddess we are.
Right.
Egotism is holding it that somehow we're better than other people. And that's just not true.
Right.
We are all equally beloved in God's heart. And you know, to say that someone is special and other someone else is lesser, I mean, it's very definitely the teaching that we've been taught.
Yeah.
And we've also been taught in this, particularly in the patriarchy of Christianity's heritage, mm-hmm. is that we're born screwed.
Yeah,
we're
right.
born
that's
broken.
That's the other thing.
And there's,
you know,
nothing we can do to fix
about
ourselves.
It. And we go through,
you know?
Life crawling on our belly,
right.
apologizing for something that we ostensibly didn't do.
Yeah, and I just
millions of years ago.
I just don't buy it myself.
No, but that's one way to subject people to control.
It is, because when we teach people that they're worthless and that they have to go through an intercessory priest or what have you to be right with God, then of course that intercessory holds great power.
Yeah.
And tends to amass great wealth, as we have seen.
No, you think?
And so, you know, you know, I know you are doing the same thing with your work, Phyllis, that I am, and that is we're calling for people to liberate themselves from all of these stories of fear and lack and worthlessness and be willing to take on the mantle of this great truth that we are all exquisite jewels of God got us.
Yes. And I agree with that. And yet there are places for priests because there are those who are moving forward slowly, but they still need that compassion. I guess because I was raised Catholic, that I still believe there is worth to that. I think that the story has been altered over millennia by selfishness and people with less than sterling motives, shall we say?
Yes.
But there is a core of truth. As I read the Bible, and I have from stem to stern, I still find it has value in it, and if I read it, each time I read it, even going over the same part, I have found something new, which is consistent with what we're talking about.
Yes, absolutely. There are many great teachings in the Bible. I'm particularly attracted to the teachings of Jesus, who really talked about unconditional love in a way that few people had before him.
Yes. And my favorite theme is that he taught us how to live, not how to die. He taught us how to live, and his life was that example, which was, we are all God. And he says that in the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
He said, we are all God. If that were not true, I would have told you so. So he is claiming also that not only he was the Son of God, but that we are all children of God.
Yeah, a woman named Barbara Marx Hubbard.
Yes, I've heard of her.
I've seen her speak numerous times, and one time she said that she felt as though she had been visited by the Spirit of Jesus while she was staying at a monastery. This is probably 25 or 30 years ago now.
Huh.
And that one of the things that he told her was that, I never wanted you to worship me.
Right.
I wanted
you
to become me.
Yes. Yes.
And
that's
very moved by that statement.
Yes, I absolutely. He showed us how to become that.
Exactly.
Okay. He didn't start an ism or a cult. That wasn't his desire. It was not his desire to be put up on a pedestal.
Exactly.
But that's what others did afterwards. But, you know, who am I? You know, I haven't been called Pope Phyllis yet. Not likely to either. But, you know, part of what we are going through is such a profound reason. Now, you talk again about emotional icebergs. Let's go back to that. Oh, dear. Do you know that we have to stop now? Do you know?
I was just looking at the clock and thinking, oh, my gosh, the hour's gone already.
Oh, well, okay. For the lady who called, I'm sorry, please call again next week. We will be able to do some readings. We're going to have to say now, I will say I have you back on again, Steve, the 5th of April. So to continue on with this, we want you back on the 5th of April.
Yes.
Again, we Steve Reels.
And it is Riles.
Riles. Steve Riles. I am sorry. I will get it one day.
It's okay.
I promise you. And I am Phyllis Pricer. The book, again, is Drunk with Wonder. It is a most amazing book. I suggest you go out and get it. You can get it from any number of sources. I assume it's on the internet. It's
It's on Amazon.com.
And
I have a website, drunkwithwonder.com, and you can subscribe to my free monthly newsletter from that website. I also have an audio version of the book that came out really great, and it's on iTunes or on audible.com.
Well, thank you very much. Again, I'm Phyllis Pricer, your hostess. It's been a joy. It's been a passion to talk about. I still feel that we could dig some more, and I'd love to, and I look forward to it. Thank you all for listening, and I welcome you back next week when I will have Marguerite Manning, who is a tarot reader. She's a delightful woman, lives in my neck of the woods, and she's very good. We can do readings then for the lady who was kind enough to call earlier. Feel free to call in. Again, I'm Phyllis Pricer. You've been listening to The Higher Dimension at BBS Radio. God bless you all, and have a wonderful week. Bye-bye.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.